As Sweden and Finland ponder whether to end the neutrality of 70 years to join NATO, we ask whether an American-led organisation with the potential for President Trump back at the helm, who regards NATO, remember, as obsolete, is that the best bet, or is it time for a European Defence Force to step forward? We look also behind the claims about Britain's new Ukrainian refugee scheme to see whether it actually equals that being offered across the rest of Europe. Sadly, the answer predictably is that it doesn't. Strings are attached. We look also at nuclear. Why on earth is it back on the agenda in a country like Scotland? And why are we approaching the Saudis, where 81 men were executed yesterday to try to get back into their oil supplies? Those are the headlines. Now for the podcast.
Hi, chums, and welcome to this week's Leslie Riddick podcast. And huzzah! Herself is back.
Yes.
How are you feeling?
Well, I'm negative, so, you know, it's official. I can now do really, you know, mind-blowingly exciting things like go shopping for food again. I mean, I got right down to the end of the, you know, the bottom of all the baskets in the freezer and finding all these, you know, things you bought like 7 years ago and thought, really? You know, so... Yeah, so I'm feeling much better. Although, I mean, apologies, people, I still sound a bit sort of nasal and, you know, that. But I guess, you know, that's just par for the course and it'll all clear up and I feel fine.
Oh,
and thanks, everybody, for all the kind of, you know, messages. It was really sweet. But it looks, it's one of those things, isn't it? Because it looks as if there's just this little rash of cases, you know, of this, perhaps it's not a new strain, is it? The BA1 thing seems to be more transmissible. It's a strange one that Scotland should be just peaking at this stage. But I mean, God, who understands? But anyway, thanks for all the, you know, the messages.
Yeah. Thanks everyone who got in touch, and thanks to everyone who subscribing to the podcast. It's been exactly coming this week a year since we launched the subscription service, and there's people have been getting in touch about it as well, which about renewal, and it happens automatically, folks. So there's nothing you need to do. But for some people who did get in touch, it did take me down the rabbit hole of discovering all the things I really didn't want to know about web management with the Stripe payment system. So that was a hoot on Sunday night. But I mean, we were able to solve any of the issues that people had. So if you do have any problems, folks, please get in touch. And I think I know how to remedy any issues that come up there.
Well, it's definitely a thing of keeping the old brain going on all the updating of every blooming system. I'm now running the Nordic Horizons website, she said tentatively. And so I've had to get myself around, you know, uploading things to SoundCloud and all this kind of thing. And it's amazing how you approach it with this, it'll not work.
Correct.
I won't get it.
Yep.
There'll be something where it says, do this, you'll do it. And then it goes, no. And then the joy that you experience when you actually manage to do it is just, I still have to keep going to the website to check. Just by the way, there is a podcast of the last event there, but just to check that it's actually there and other people could click on it and it's not a figment of my imagination.
Oh, God.
You know?
It's not just me then, because I just about did a lap of honour around the house when I actually managed to reinstate the subscription that had been cancelled accidentally. And I thought, and bizarrely, it came under create subscription. And you're all, who knew after the half an hour that only had to look at, oh, create subscription. And there it was. But the Nordic Horizons event, Leslie, that formed the background to your recent article in the Herald, and it looked incredibly interesting.
Yeah, well, it was a Ukraine, you know, it's still sitting absolutely, you know, dominating everything. And quite apart from the keeping abreast of the current developments, and they are huge. The sort of ripple effect is now spreading through the different policy outlooks of all sorts of different countries.
Yeah.
I mean, you can look at Germany particularly that, you know, has done this completely 180 degree turn on its pacifist, you know, non-militarized status over since the Second World War. I mean, that's an huge factor. But quietly, of course, people will also be aware that Finland and Sweden have had opinion polls. In the case of Finland, more particularly because it has this long 1,300 kilometre border, land border with Russia. The Finns have always been essentially neutral. As it turned out in this Nordic Horizons event, there is, as I say, you can listen to the podcast of it on the site. Amazingly, the Swedes and the Finns both decided not to join NATO in 1952. The Finns, for the reason that it would be an open provocation to a country they were still having to deal with in terms of reparations, because of the wars that they'd had with Russia, the second of which was in alliance with Hitler, which ended up with Finland having to produce goods, basically, to offer reparations mm-hmm. to Russia. So there's no way it was going to join a transatlantic American-led alliance, which could end up with American soldiers on Finnish soil. So it was just out for Finland. But Sweden's position was interesting, and I didn't know the innards of it. One of the speakers in this event, Hans Mauritsen, who's a Danish security academic and international relations specialist, was saying really that the Swedes just looked at the situation and thought, the minute we join NATO, the Finns, I think he put it very precisely, 2 days later will get a letter from Moscow inviting them to join the Warsaw Pact. And the Baltic will basically have an iron curtain right down it between Finland and Sweden. And that will create that would have created a completely different Baltic. So the Swedes realized that actually if Finland couldn't join NATO, neither could they.
Yeah.
So partly as a sort of gesture of solidarity with a country that they had previously run themselves, really. I mean, a lot of Swedes still regarded Finland as essentially just an extended part of Sweden, but partly from their own enlightened self-interest, not to turn the Baltic into a massively militarized, you know, wall of steel on all sides, they decided also not to join NATO. Norway and Denmark were founding members of NATO, so they were different. They went straight in. But they, as again it turned out in the discussion, they sort of placed restrictions on themselves in the sense that Norway has had an unofficial policy of not allowing NATO nuclear submarines into its ports. That's lapsed recently, but it mm-hmm. stood for, you know, a very long time. And the Danes had negotiated all sorts of opt-outs, some from NATO that stopped American soldiers or any bases on their land, which they've just changed. And another opt-out from the European Union when they joined, so that they didn't need to join in the military wing, if you like, of the yeah. European Union. So if they do stuff in the world, it's peacekeeping stuff. And indeed, Ireland's in much the same boat.
Exactly, yeah.
But as far as the Scandinavians were concerned, that's a contiguous land area which had all got, to varying degrees, a sort of level of withholdingness or sort of restraint. Right up to full non-alignment in case of Finland and Sweden because of the Russian threat. So here we are now. As I say, it's extraordinary the change that has been in Finnish public opinion. A week before the Russian invasion of Ukraine, 24% of Finns wanted to join NATO. A week after the invasion of Ukraine, 53% yeah. of Finns want to join NATO. Now, the question is, what to do with that? There's been a similar shift in Sweden. And I mean, what was interesting in the discussion is that the Finnish expert who was there, Johanna Vuorelma, there's a lot of caution because, you know, this policy of non-alignment is almost part of the identity of a Finn now. Mm-hmm. It's been such a long-standing thing. I've seen commentary that suggests much the same is true of Germans. It might be a bit, I mean, these are ridiculous analogies, but if you've had COVID, even when you've tested negative, you're still staying away from everybody. You know, behaviour doesn't leave you quickly. And that's 70 years of non-alignment in the Finns' case. They also wonder what joining NATO would do, because that would essentially bring the front line right up to the border with Russia in a way that, you know, it just might not be the best thing.
Yeah.
It might bring you right full circle back to a situation that we last saw, you know, at the last Cold War. And this prompted the discussion about whether or not, given that so many European countries are now stepping up to the 2% contribution, or, well, 2% of GDP into defence, is that money best sent into NATO or best put into a kitty for a separate European defence fund? This was the beginning of the discussion. Now, I'm sure as far as President Putin's concerned, it doesn't matter. When I was looking back into some of the history of Ukraine, the revolution that started in 2014, the Revolution of Dignity, it was called, occurred. This is 2014, and that triggered Russia's invasion and annexation of Crimea and so on. And that happened because the then Russian-backed Ukrainian president wouldn't sign a free trade agreement with the EU. He was being so muscled into signing an agreement instead with Russia. So actually, Russian invasion then was of the Crimea was triggered just simply by a free trade agreement possibility with the EU. So you'd have to say, I don't know that, you know, anybody could realistically say that simply having an EU defence force and being a member of that for Ukraine would somehow be a guaranteed thing that would stop President Putin seeing that as some sort of threat, you know, American based threat. The American bit would be with would be lost. But I mean, the point made very strongly by the Norwegian analyst, Eva Neumann, was everyone is sort of forgetting a little bit that there's not just two kind of one dodgy tyrant, if you like, in the shape of Putin in this story. 5 years ago, there was another one called Donald Trump. And if you look back about his views on NATO, he described it as obsolete. He was trying to cut the budgets, although I think in the end he never actually did. And he was making it really clear that the interests of America were now focused, and Joe Biden has echoed this, focused on the kind of Far East and the possibility of China invading Taiwan. And they felt that basically Europe had been a bunch of freeloaders. That was Trump's view, particularly Germany, with a massive economy that wasn't basically paying anything into defence. And that the Europeans should just get organised and take over their own defence policy and funding. Now, you know, it's a horrible thing to be suggesting this at whatever time of day you're listening to this podcast, but he could be back.
Yeah.
And if not him, as Eva was pointing out in the podcast, if you listen to the Republican Party, as he put it, it has left democracy. You know, it's scary stuff listening to a lot of these guys. And if you watched any of those rallies of Trump talking about Putin, you know, that there's a wing of the Republicans that thinks he's some kind of superhero still. Now, you know, here we're sitting with an alliance dominated by one party, one country, whose leadership is pretty dodgy. And unfortunately, Joe Biden's ratings are, you know, are such that it could well be a Republican president in a couple of years' time. So it's kind of like everybody's now, I think, in Europe has got to really start asking themselves some really tough questions about the structures that have existed since the Second World War, relatively unscrutinized, with America sitting at the helm. And whether or not that's going to be okay, you know, there's also the point people were talking about the possibility of having a non-nuclear European defence force.
Well, yeah. There's
the problem of France. It's got its own nuclear deterrent. I mean, there's loads of problems with this as an idea, just loads. But there's problems with the status quo, you know. So so that was basically the thrust of the discussion. And it just does give you a sense of how complex, you know, that it's shining a light, basically, what's happened in Ukraine on all sorts of dependencies, on dodgy deals, on things that you say in public and in private. It's really not that way. Germany, particularly, when you look at the German situation, they are absolutely so dependent on, it's not even just gas is actually some of the least of it, oil and coal, you know, from Russia. If they go cold turkey, they will have to keep their nuclear power stations going and keep their coal power stations going, which will completely scupper their attempts at, you know, hitting climate change credentials and denuclearizing, which Angela Merkel announced in the wake of the Fukushima disaster. Yeah. So, you know, there's no easy routes out of this. Obviously, renewables would be you know, this is a big thing they need to consider, but they haven't got any of the easy big wins on that that other countries have got. So everybody's sitting quietly with very difficult decisions ahead, but it feels like there's a lot of possible movement.
Yeah, because, I mean, one of the other key aspects, Leslie, is that the European Constitution, which developed after the Lisbon Treaty, explicitly prohibits a common defence. You know, so that would have to be got over. And again, the focus on the Nordics, Ireland, as you mentioned, has this neutrality policy, which isn't really, you know, what we mean by neutrality. You know, I mean, they do contribute greatly to the United Nations Defence Force. And they've had a series of polls as well. And a majority in Ireland is now in favour of participation in a common European defence arrangement. However, unlike what's happened in Finland, 34% of people prior to the invasion of Ukraine believe that Ireland should join NATO. That's only gone up to 37%. And looking at Ireland, I mean, they've got a foreign policy that, you know, I think would chime with a lot of Scots, in that it's peaceful resolution of disputes, support for human rights, nuclear non-proliferation, arms control, the rights of small nations, etc., that I think we could all sign up to. And Ben Tonra of the University College Dublin said that Ireland might be described as a good citizen, you know, and I think that's looking at what I would like to see Scotland as, and many of us would like to see, would be Scotland would be a good citizen. And the implications of a potential European Defence Force versus membership of NATO, which again was voted for narrowly by SNP conference prior to the referendum, would that be up for grabs, do you think, in a post-independent Scotland? Would be a reconsideration taken of not joining NATO with the potential to be enthralled to either a democratic president who is more interested in the Far East, or a Republican president who would be pro-authoritarian, not anti-Putin, you know, in charge and being the major player in NATO? Would a European Defence Force be more acceptable to Scots?
Well, it might be, but there'll still be this issue of what is done with with the Trident submarines that are sitting on our soil. I mean, I know when I've spoken to kind of Nordic neighbours, they just don't understand the Scots' position on the Trident submarines. But this is partly because, I mean, for the Norwegians, their position, where they have traditionally been anti-nuclear submarines, even in their ports, and they have none themselves, that kind of rests on the fact someone else does. You know, so yes. A lot of these guys are sort of resting on the fact that there's British, French, American nuclear deterrents sitting around so that they don't have to. So it's kind of, for them, it's like an unwritten deal that the folk who are right up near the border, who can't look like they're, you know, openly arming up, mm-hmm. are reliant on the folk in the back row who are sitting with the big guns, basically, should it all go wrong. It's very hard to, you know, it's very hard to have a discussion then about that. But they do appreciate that as countries become independent, characteristics of their own become quite marked in what to other people might look sort of odd arrangements. Like, for example, the Norwegians. I mean, as Ivar said, Norway couldn't cozy up further to the European Union without being a member now. You know, mm-hmm. it's so close, but it just won't join. And it just won't join because 70% of the population outside Oslo didn't want to be controlled by some, even Oslo, never mind, you know, anywhere else. And because there was such a lot of money put by the Norwegian government traditionally into supporting its own people staying on land, which is very poor. So they feared that if they joined the EU, the common, you know, the common policies they would be forced into, including the common fisheries policy, which is obviously huge for them as well, those would basically decimate a country that has put lots of its subsidy into keeping people in its most remote areas in good, prosperous, well-connected, jobs, and in areas with really impressive infrastructure. So that's the baggage that Norway took with it into, if you like, into, you know, Europe and and through independence, is a wariness of any interference with the way that it runs its country. And despite the fact that they are, you know, hugely pro-European, they still vote, I don't know what the latest statistic was, but only 18% of Norwegians want to be in the EU. Mm-hmm. Now, that's as illogical on the face of it as it may, as Scotland's determination to become nuclear free might look to them, you know. Yeah. But I don't know, you know, I mean, I see an article, a very provocative article by Neil Mackay in today's Herald, basically saying that the SNP should just be honest and say that independence isn't happening anytime soon and just give up on it because everyone's exhausted. And I mean, you know, I find just in my very few forays, in fact, let's be honest, my one foray to Fort William for the excellent Yes Lough Abra event, that at the same time, there's incredible enthusiasm for independence. I mean, those who now support independence see, I think, with fairly complete clarity how important it is, why it should work, and they're ready to go to try to get that done. At the same time, there's just a feeling that absolutely there's no preparations being made, and, you know, it doesn't feel like we're getting any honest honesty, actually, from the SNP Green Alliance now as to what really is lying in the future. But I guess, so coming back to your question about that issue of defence policy, I mean, God almighty, we haven't even got a published policy on currency, you know. We should be talking about all of these things. And yet, I mean, here's this little group, Nordic Horizons. As far as I can see, we're the only people in the Nordic countries who've gathered these people together to have a discussion about the future of the latitude that we share. Mm-hmm. So it seems extraordinary to me how little discussion there is going on in a sort of civic way. But there you go.
Yeah, because it was that furore when Ian Blackford said, you know, we can't be talking about an independence referendum in the midst of the Ukraine crisis. And I mean, I get it. I do get it, the thinking behind it. You occasionally say to me, if there is any thinking behind it, that the appeal is being made to non-yes supporters, the soft no's, that look, we're sober, we're responsible. We took a responsible stance over Brexit. We're taking a responsible stance over this. We are there to be trusted. You know, they're not speaking to thee and me. But I mean, it was disquieting to see that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think we'll agree it was disquieting.
Yes, there was no more you could say about
it. It is that kind of point. And I'm smiling because, I mean, and I do think there's a difference to be made, Leslie, in terms of perspective of people out in the real world as opposed to folk who comment on it, that I know that I can become very jaded occasionally, thinking nothing's happening, nothing's going on, whereas there is amongst people out there who are not the commentariat, there is still a burning desire and a drive and waiting for things to happen. And I shouldn't let my feeling of the inertia of the SNP in terms of this colour everything that's going on.
Yeah, it's hard, you know, you can only live through the prism of your own experience. Yeah. It can often seem strange because, again, if you're speaking to people further the parish completely, their perception is that everyone's just waiting for the Scottish government to, you know, announce a referendum. And for the first time in a long time, they understand why.
Yeah.
You know, so from their point of view, but there's always that time, like, you know, from outside, everyone thought Obama was a brilliant president over here.
Yeah.
You know, there's always a time lag from outside where the internal problems that are kind of pulling internal politics apart are not so apparent. And you're left with a slightly, you know, you're just left with a vision of what the big question hanging over the country is. Mm-hmm. And for everyone outside us, it's still that we are the ones who want out of a British state that just keeps showing itself in the worst possible light. And, you know, you, my friend, have looked into the whole refugee issue, which is just before we start, though. I mean, again, we didn't talk about this in huge detail, but I mean, everybody else has stepped up so completely. I see that just to relieve you of the need to talk about football, which I know is a vexed topic after last night's game.
Yes.
In Finland, their former their captain, who I think is a Czech guy, has given his home in Vaasa to a family of Ukrainian refugees. But what's interesting is, and they're already in, you know, because every other normal country has just let people straight in. But what he's starting to do now is arranging football coaching for all the children with local teams. And now there's a thing in Finland, wherever the Ukrainian refugees are going, is that the local football teams are getting coaching organised for all the children, boys and girls, which I think is a tremendous, it's a small detail, but a tremendously good idea to help the kids who are just so traumatised, you know, bond with each other and just do something kind of practical. I see also that when I was looking on at Helsinki, the transport, the official transport map online has suddenly acquired a Vladimir Zelensky park at the Russian embassy's address, which is just, it's these little things. I appreciate a lot of them have happened in Scotland with the changing, the thing that's sitting on top of the statue outside the Museum of Modern Art. But so there's been all these kind of attempts by the populace to sort of demonstrate solidarity. But take it away, Pat.
Yeah, well, I'm going to link in just very quickly, though, to say that on the front page of yesterday's Courier, my three grandchildren were there at my oldest granddaughter, Freya Rose, was involved with the group of Newport primary school kids, because Newport is twin with Zolotarevo in Ukraine, and they raised £1,500 yesterday just by the Bairns doing a wee walk. Before anybody says anything, this is a part of a pattern with my grandkids and my daughter and son-in-law. They were heavily involved in fundraising for Afghani and Syrian refugees when they were living in Glasgow. So it's not just a focus on Ukraine, you know. And it was it was great to see. But again, the Homes for Ukraine scheme that was announced and Michael Gove, you know, trumpeting it. And what it is, it's phase one, you see. I mean, that's what worries me. Phase one, you know. Yeah, there's going to be other phases, I mean, because we've been incredibly slow here in comparison, as you said, to other European nations. You're allowed to nominate a named Ukrainian or a named Ukrainian family, you know, to stay with them in their home in a separate property. And as the Labour Party have rightly described it, I think it's a DIY asylum. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have... You should have to be able to contact these people directly, fill in a visa application. And they reckon there's going to be about 10,000 at the start, and they're going to get 3 years leave. But the problem is they're still not being recognised as refugees, Leslie. They have to apply for visas. No, and it doesn't mean that any Ukrainian can get in here. What it also does is it doesn't allow for vulnerable children to get in here. You know, we keep going back to the heavy lifting done by Kinder Transport in the run-up to the outbreak of World War One, where 10,000 kids got in. And it was the exact opposite then, because the 10,000 kids, and that was an open-ended policy, their parents weren't allowed in. So, and as you said, the trauma was incredible, because these kids were thrust into foster families. They lost their parents and, all their whole families, because they weren't allowed in. And the Refugee Council have said it's a complex visa application process. They say it needs to be speedy and compassionate, and that's not what this government is known for. And another aspect of it as well is that there's still going to have to be what Gove claims to be a light-touch security checks, but very little, if any, checks being done on where these people are being placed. And they've said it's akin to children being placed with foster carers without any checks being done. And a lot of these are going to be traumatised women and children who are arriving here. And without proper checks being done on where they're going, or even having social workers attached to them, you know? And it just smacks entirely of too little, too late, overly bureaucratic. Why don't they just open the doors as has been done right across Europe? And Micheál Martin, for I've got very little time for in all sorts of areas, the Irish Taoiseach, was incredibly articulate in expressing what has been the European nation's response, even out with the European Union, to this, which is open your doors, let folk in, waive visa requirements. It was done for kinder transport, you know? It could be done now. And it doesn't beggar belief. It absolutely fits in entirely with the perspective of this government. One, they're incompetent. They couldn't organise a booze up in a brewery. And two, they're mean-spirited and always look at, they don't look out for people in the way, in the compassionate way that any normal set of human beings with a developed sense of empathy and humanity would do.
Yeah. And kind of once again, you know, Britain having perhaps had some status at the start of this with Boris Johnson, you know, storming around the place and going to Estonia, and there being a substantial amount of British presence in the Estonian NATO presence there, has blown that completely by now presiding over this utter shambles again, where, you know, you see it on the news every night of these poor folks stuck. Well, where are they stuck now? You know, sort of jumping between place and place. And then the thing that is constantly baffling is, do they not think that any journalist will check stuff up?
Yeah.
You know, that when they decided that, you know, there's going to be this new sort of embassy or temporary embassy or something in Lille, you know, the first thing somebody did was just go online, try to get an appointment and discover that it was only open a tiny, tiny number of hours to pre-arranged invited people. Well, did they not think that any of us were ever going to find that out? And it's the same story, it's the same script as almost everything they do, where a sort of official propaganda line is put up, rapidly disintegrates with the first person who bothers to check on it. After that, they're on their back foot trying to kind of add, you know, whistles and whatever else to it to try to kind of, you know, bolster their original. It's just, it's shocking. And then, of course, it's the juxtaposition as well, because all the time that you're seeing this attempt to just stick to the Britain for British, which is really what's at the base of all of this, actually. It's the base of Brexit, it's the base of their immigration policy, their revolting stuff, which is still en route to becoming law, despite the fact that the House of Lords tried to have another push back on the Nationality and Borders Bill. All of that stuff is part of a default that they have built up over an extremely long period of time. And, you know, you're seeing the juxtaposition between the meanness of that and then the extraordinary things that are happening in other countries. Like, I mean, if people have seen that extraordinary journalist, Marina Ozyanikova, who is the woman who is an editor on Russia's state-controlled Channel One, who put a protest on air live yesterday for a few seconds with this sign saying, "No war, stop the war, don't believe the propaganda, they're lying to you." And if you see the pre-recorded, she knew she would be lifted and possibly disappear. And indeed, she has been lifted and apparently has nobody can track down what station she's in, police station. But she pre-recorded a message knowing what would happen. And honestly, it just leaves you in tears watching it with just the courage and clarity of it. You know, when she's talking about, you know, her shame in having basically been complicit in just pouring propaganda out to the Russian people. And I mean, there's one phrase that she'd got in there where she said, 10 generations will not wash away the shame from Russia. You know, that it has now become a pariah state. And this is the thing that, I mean, many of us might be watching, you know, just ambling our way through the latest Killing Eve, you know, episodes. And the Russians within that, you know, they're presented by, you know, the very affable Dame Kim Bodnia, who was, you know, involved in all the Danish series. He was the in the original of the bridge, and sort of so that he's deliberately chosen to front up that sort of, you know, slightly quirky. They like the like Burns poetry. They like vodka. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the kind of Russians, and you know, they're lefties. I mean, okay, there's a bit of a problem with Stalin, but. You know, there's that sort of approach still sitting roughly towards Russia somewhere in our psyche. And she's saying, no, this is it. We've become the new Germany.
Yeah.
You know, we've become where they were, where one man turned a country into a pariah state. And that's an extraordinary thing to say. I mean, you know, she levels the finger directly at President Putin and says it is him that is driving this. Now, I mean, I don't know if we'll ever see this woman again, but that is some extraordinary gesture to make.
Yeah. And I mean, it, as you just say, it stands in comparison to the mealy-mouthed enthrall to Russian influence. Right throughout British society and the British economy and British cultural institutions that we've seen go on right underneath our noses. And I mean, you've just had the, I mean, you look at Evgeny Lebedev. I mean, he's been a pal of Boris Johnson since 2009. You know, his father was a KGB agent, in which Lebedev himself says, oh, it was a long time ago. Yeah. 1988, Lebedev's father, who moved seamlessly from the KGB into the new Russian State Security Agency and moved seamlessly from that to become a billionaire oligarch. Yeah, he was the KGB head of the KGB in London, you know, and that's who now is placed in the House of Lords, despite the warnings from MI6 to Boris Johnson directly telling him not to put him in there. And you've got two ways you can look at this. Either it's just doing a favour to his mate, you know, because the Evening Standard had been the Lebedevs owned the Evening Standard and the Independent, folks, and they supported Boris Johnson throughout his mayoral campaign and continued to support him later on. And is he doing his mate a favour, or is there something else going on there? And the continuing acceptance of that dirty money that was fundamentally gained by stealing the assets of the Soviet state and taking it into private hands and pauperising the Russian people. And the money flooded into London, flooded into football clubs. I mean, you've got Abramovich at Chelsea. You had Usmanov, who was at my club, Arsenal, has now moved to Everton. And football clubs have traditionally been methods of money laundering. And it happened under everybody's watch and directly under their noses. So I'm not a conspiracy theorist. Is it just the fact of this is capitalism? This is the way it works. We don't really care where the money comes from. Or is there something more sinister going on? But it's been an appalling situation that's been allowed to develop. And as you said earlier on, hopefully this horrible experience of the invasion of Ukraine is shedding a light on these nooks and crannies of the dark areas of our country that we currently in, and shed more light on what happened in the Brexit campaign and Aaron Banks and where all that money came from and the dark money that continues to be involved in UK politics.
Yeah, it seems to me that this is, if as we discussed before, if the City of London is regarded as the sort of prime driver of British, British elite control, then all things will be sacrificed at that altar.
Mm-hmm.
And the analysts looking at the reluctance of the Tories to bring in the economic crimes bill that surprisingly has now been, you know, that couldn't be done quickly, but is now actually being dealt with. And of course, you've got to watch them like hawks because they'll try to find every loophole to not really be clamping down. And the enforcement is always the thing. But, you know, all of that is apparently not the Russians are the biggest users of these kind of, you know, the London laundromat. It's the Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, without wishing to become, you know, xenophobic about it, there are large parts of the world with political attitudes espoused and maintained and enforced by political governing elites whose stashing of cash seems to belie their own political positions.
Yes.
You know, whether it's Putin or the Chinese that are stashing their money in the city of London, despite being hugely opposed to capitalism, or indeed, if it doesn't seem too appalling to throw Jacob Rees-Mogg into the mix, you know, the great supporter of Brexit who keeps his money in, you know, the Eurozone.
Yeah.
I mean, it is like nothing really matters to these guys on that front. It is just their control.
Yeah, and meanwhile, I mean, while this is going on, Boris Johnson is attempting to cozy up to the Saudis to reach some deal over cheaper oil. And at the same time, the Saudis have just beheaded 81 men for alleged terrorism and deviant beliefs. You know, and we cozy up to the Saudis and continually, and when we examine what's going on, there has been a significant attempt. We saw it with Russia. I mean, the corrupt bid that saw them get the World Cup through with FIFA in 2018. That, and it's the involvement of sport within this has been a significant element, not only in money laundering, but a significant element to legitimize and disguise what's going on in these regimes. I mean, and the term sport washing was introduced in about 2015, but it's gone on forever. We just reflect on the Berlin Olympics, you know, 1978 World Cup in Argentina under the junta, you know, where Scotland still went and played. And it's this way that regimes and business people utilize sport in order to disguise the intention of what they're really about and legitimize their activities. And the Saudis are deeply embedded within this. I mean, they've taken over ownership of Newcastle United. It'll be interesting to see what happens there, given the fact of, you know, the sanctions, the incredible sanctions being placed on Chelsea by the UK government, but yet the takeover of Newcastle United by the Saudis, that's perfectly okay. They're our authoritarians. They're all right. And the Saudis have been pouring billions into these events. They just attempted to set up an alternative golf tour, which failed. Behind it all, of course, is Mohammed bin Salman with the Vision 2030. And that's the guy, yeah, who has been now identified by US intelligence services as the man who authorized of the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. Oh, identified as such, but not having any personal sanctions placed on them by the Biden government. So it's right at the heart of our culture, and it's right at the heart of football clubs like Manchester City, Newcastle United, Chelsea, Everton. Dirty money coming into this country and it being whitewashed by its involvement in sport. And people who would normally rail at the human rights abuses and the authoritarianism in these countries being sucked into it through their involvement in community football clubs and other matters like that. And it's, as I say, it's one, and there's nothing being done about it as well. I mean, the Amnesty have called for an owners and directors test to have a human rights element to it. This government, nah, we're not doing that. And in fact, government minister just came out and defended the Saudis' right to own Newcastle United, saying they were proud to have this investment in the UK and shows it's a great place to put your money.
I mean, people will be saying, God, this, you know, we had a couple of misery podcasts before this, but I think we're definitely back in the zone. But all of this, I've sort of slightly lost track of weeks here because we didn't have one last week. But I mean, I wrote a thing, I don't think we discussed it, about this, the sort of the nuclear is back loving that happened. Oh, I wrote a piece for The National the previous week. During Prime Minister's questions, there was many things that came up. But the thing that just caught my ear was the basically sort of trying to outdo each other for support of nuclear energy between Boris Johnson and Keir Starmer. And in the midst of it, of course, this was just another, you know, Boris was basically blaming Labour for cancelling nuclear plants, which is baffling because actually Labour had not been in power at any of the point, you know, that I couldn't find any cancelled nuclear plants. what you can find is Hinckley C 10 years practically, you know, overdue and still not likely to come into service until 2027. Currently, and I mean, quite astonishingly, I just didn't realise this until you sort of drilled down a little bit. There's actually a bill going through Parliament at the moment to try and enable public funds to match private investment to give guarantees ahead of the energy rolling, which is the normal way that, you know, these things work, for the construction of nuclear power plants, because nobody basically will touch nuclear with a barge pole. At the moment, you know, despite the City of London being awash for many years with cash that could have been put into Hinckley C, no British firm would invest in it. It was the French and the Chinese group which have invested in it. Oops-a-daisy in terms of the Chinese, because that's now, you know, the role the Chinese have in infrastructure across the world is pretty scary. If you just put in the Silk Road Initiative, Chinese ports, I haven't done it recently, but there's hundreds of ports which have quietly been bought over by Chinese interests. And suddenly it didn't look very good for the British government to have a nuclear power station that was partly owned and run by a Chinese group, CGN. So they're now trying to find new investors to ease out the Chinese. And it's not, there's not exactly a queue developing. So this is, let's just, this is the reality, people, behind, you know, the nuclear power. And this is what they're now having a kind of war of words in. That's going to be the great solution, is more nuclear power plants, which would take, I mean, all the experts will agree that, you know, in the best of all possible schemes is 18 years. That's the quickest you can possibly get through everything. And even then, you've got all the questions about radioactive waste, you know, just all the planning issues, who wants them. There's another proposal to have Sizewell C, but it's now seems to have completely run aground, and nobody thinks that it could produce any electricity until the early 2030s. Now, I mean, renewables takes a tenth of that time. And it just, it does kind of, you know, again, with the nuclear plants, Chernobyl's back in the news, but it's not an active power plant. Still, it's dangerous enough. But there are active power plants that look as if they're being targeted by the Russians to just kind of prove a point. How on earth are we back at the stage where there's a suggestion that well, Britain, you can do what you want south of the border, although obviously Scotland would be affected by any downside. Scotland does not need new nuclear capacity. It does not. We are lucky enough to have be a pretty much awash with energy, and also the sort of tidal and hydro energy that provides the base load, which is what you can switch, you know, use at the drop of a switch that you can quickly bring into the energy mix. There's a lot of people who will point out that the more that you have intermittent supplies like wind, the more that you need something to kind of balance it that can always be there. For other countries, it's different types of things. But, you know, all our neighbours, again, across the North Sea, are not using nuclear as that base load mix. And Scotland doesn't need it. But as long as this nonsense continues, I mean, one expert I spoke to, put it this way and said, you know, if you have a mindset that wants Scotland kept at heel politically, then you will want to see Scotland with nuclear and fossil energy tied and locked into UK policy.
Yeah, that's precisely what I was going to say, because meanwhile, as nuclear comes rolling back, guess what? It's, oh, we've got to extract the gas and oil. We've got to get into this, you know, to give us energy security. And that suddenly come back. And not just, I mean, I noticed Fergus Ewing, you know, not unsurprisingly from my perspective, that Fergus Ewing suddenly came out and said that we should actually, you know, reevaluate our perspectives on oil and gas extraction in the light of this crisis. And again, the light of this crisis, you know, you had the COVID crisis, you've got the Ukraine crisis, that's all these things that are going to be rolled up into it to try and get us back in and forget about all the agreements and the dire necessity to actually incredibly reduce our dependency on fossil fuels. is going to go out the window, and we're going to be back to that. And the excuse will be the Ukraine crisis and security of energy supply.
Yeah, but if you do, you know, it's interesting to just drill into what people are saying about some of the length of time. I mean, there's that these things would take. I mean, there's one woman, Naomi Oreskes, who is a professor of the history of science at Harvard, and she's writing about the Americans who have been very sort of nuclear dependent. The most recent US nuclear reactors were started in 2013 and are still not finished.
Right.
She said, there's a problem with imagined breakthrough technologies. The breakthrough can be sudden, but the implementation is slow. Mm-hmm. I bear that in mind with, you know, the talk that there's been about fission, all the various other possibilities that have been just around the corner, as she put it, just around the corner since 1943. The small modular reactors, they're called SMRs. Rolls-Royce has been saying these can be constructed more cheaply, built in a factory, transported in modules, and fitted together, quote, like Meccano. So far, the only operating SMR in the world is in Russia. Just leave that there. And there have been some attempts in Britain. Hitachi had come up with a project in Wales, Toshiba in Cumbria. They've both been mothballed. And that's because they did just the money looks at it, looks at the fact that the costs of nuclear construction have risen threefold over the last decade. The costs of solar are five times lower. The cost of wind, three times lower. This is just, why are we continuing to run after this at all costs? I mean, it actually, setting all the lobbying, all of it aside, it actually is baffling. And there's Labour in there. Well, actually, when I just was trying to understand where Labour's outlook came from, because Tony Benn was a great nuclear enthusiast until he left office. Until he left office and became a huge anti-nuclear campaigner. So the Unite Union, Sue Ferns, is quoted as saying, Labour's perceived ambivalence towards nuclear power, well, there you go, has been a factor in the recent loss of seats like Warrington, Barrow and Furness, Innsmonds in Wales and Hartlepool. And she says, in fact, there are now no nuclear power stations represented by Labour MPs.
Yeah.
There it is.
Yeah,
that's what, you know, I mean, really, it is that cynical. And meanwhile, back at the fort, the very day that Keir Starmer was in there listing nuclear and absolutely, you know, we're champions of nuclear power, the great alternative source of baseload energy in Britain, certainly in England, the Severn Tidal Barrage, the local councils on both sides of the Severn in Wales and England had come together to try yet again to try and get electricity from the second biggest tidal range in the world. Right. That's the level of resource they're sitting with. If it was successfully harnessed, it could generate alone 7% of the UK's total energy needs, not just electricity, energy needs. And yet this gathering of these councils is the 15th attempt to do it in two centuries.
Right.
And the reason, according to the leader of Cardiff Council, the UK government has not lent its support.
Right. Yes.
So, you know, what's going on? Every time that nuclear comes to the fore, the marine possibilities of tidal and wave get jettisoned. And we come back to the dependencies that the City of London has set up in almost the nature of the British body politic. The cheap shots, the easy sort of almost addictions, really, the kind of trading solutions, the long supply chains, the turning of blind eyes, the rhetoric in one direction about democracy and the acceptance of any sort of money because that's the way it works. All of that sits behind not being prepared to put to back the energy possibilities that this country is surrounded by.
And the technology.
Not nuclear.
Yeah, and the technology exists, Leslie. I mean, it's there. This is not pie in the sky 15, 20 years to get on the go. It's there. It can be done. It's being done elsewhere. And at some point, you would hope that capitalism would see sense and say, there's profit to be made. We can actually do this. And that's just an acceptance of the fact of the society and system we live in. Or are they so tied into the structures that we've got, that even capitalism, you know, in terms of search of profit, cannot get itself out of this trackle.
Well, there's a, I mean, I am no expert in all the innards of the financing of it, but the way that the British government, which controls energy and investment in things, it works, is through contracts for difference, where it sees it almost auctions off a kind of piece of sea in this instance for either offshore wind or tidal. And it currently makes all forms of technology compete against one another. So the one which is currently cheapest will always win that contract. So unless Tidal gets its own sort of and substantial and long-term funding stream, then it will always keep losing out in those battles, the same way that wind always kept losing out. I mean, you know, there's precedence to this, but it needs protection. And there has been a small fund set up. The S&P did make a big fuss about this, actually, at Westminster. Ian Blackford made it the subject of his questioning for a couple of weeks, and it did pay off. But now there's a fund for 1 year only, and that's not enough for the long-term investments that need to be made. So it's, of course, there could be, you know, there's an eye to the long term. And the tragedy of the thing is that at the moment, and I'm sorry if I'm repeating myself, but I think it bears repetition. Scotland particularly is actually almost number one in the world for tidal technology skills. And our guys are constantly being approached by other countries to simply relocate. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, how long does anyone expect that they're going to sit here in an environment that is, you know, that is just hostile to them continually and dismissive? And that one exchange at Prime Minister's questions would be enough for any energy analyst to think, you know, we're still on this kind of quick 18-year solution instead of investing in renewables.
And as you said, it is that the whole cynical aspect of the current iteration of the Labour Party, purely viewing this as electoral prism rather than actually looking at climate change, you know, and that just says it all about the as I say, the new Labour Party and their search for votes rather than doing the right thing and thinking anyway. But again, as McGrath used to say to me, aye, being so cheery keeps you going. but honestly, on a note, Jill and I went to see The Duke, which is a lovely, doesn't overstay its welcome, about an hour and 25 minutes film, based on a true story about the guy back in the early 60s, I think it's 61, who stole the Goya painting of the Duke of Wellington. The theft, why he did it, I won't tell too much of the story, and it is genuinely worthwhile going to see. It is not the greatest movie that's ever been made, but it will lift your spirits, cheer you up on all sorts of levels. And I'm not one of these left-wing cynics who turns around and says, oh yeah, you know, it's just one of these ones where, you know, it just it's a happy ending and everything's all right with the world because the guy, you know, whatever, you know. No, it'll lift your spirits, it cheers you up, and it's well worth going to see. And I say it won't overstay its welcome, unlike the Batman, which is over 3 hours. The other thing I'm going to say is, and I don't know how many people get access to it, it's a brilliant mini-series, 11 episodes, The Only Murders in the Building, starring Steve Martin and Martin Short, and featuring Nathan Lane, three of my favourite light comedians and actors. And it is an absolute delight, and it's a genuine comedy, genuinely dramatic, it's incredible if you get access to Disney Plus. And I know people may cavil at that, but it's go and see The Duke. I recommend it.
I was watching the BAFTAs to see if Ciarán Hinds won the best supporting actor, and he didn't. But actually, if you were watching it, the guy who won is some blooming guy, Troy Kotsur. I hadn't heard of him. He's the first deaf winner of a BAFTA. And he got it for a film, Coda. I mean, this film actually picked up quite a number of awards. And in his signed acceptance speech, he had a brilliant moment where he basically said, now that he'd got the attention of everybody, he just wanted to make a pitch to become the first deaf James Bond. I mean, it was a fabulous moment, but yes. Then serious points made out of it. Mm-hmm. But really, this looks like an absolutely terrific film about deaf people with a signer in their midst. I don't know what the full story is, but I'm definitely going to go and see it. Yeah. It's called Coda.
Yeah, I picked up on that. And for those of you with a musical intent, we went to see Cyrano, starring the marvellous Peter Dinklage, which is a reimagining in terms of a musical of Cyrano de Bergerac. And it's if people know Peter Dinklage, who's an amazing actor from Game of Thrones, and it's a reimagining. And again, you know, it's a good watch, and it's thoroughly enjoyable and a musical. So again, all is not doom and gloom, and despite all that's going on in the world, and hopefully, fingers crossed, on that uplifting note, we'll see you next week, chaps.